This is an interview for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program dealing with the Youngstown community, the Youngstown Jewish community, more specifically the Rabbi Sidney Berkowitz. The interviewee is Mrs. Pauline Berkowitz. The interview is taking place at her residence at 4000 Logangate Road, Youngstown, Ohio, on July 22, 1992, at approximately 11:06 in the morning. The interviewer is Matthew Butts. We normally do. We start off with some biographical questions about the interviewee. Okay. Can you just tell me something about your own childhood, where you grew up, where you were born?
I was born in London, England, and I grew up in that small town. And when I was 10 years old, I was sent to a school in Belgium in order to learn French. I was sent to a Carmelite convent school where I stayed until I was 16 years old. So I learned French. I got to know the Belgians very well, and they're an incredibly wonderful people. And all I can remember of my childhood among the Belgians was kindness and fun. And they treated children beautifully, not like the English, who children weren't even spoken to until they were almost of college age. They were basically ignored in England, whereas the Belgian families were much more open and happier, and just had a different attitude. It isn't relevant to anything we did here in Youngstown. My mother became very ill. We were in London, and in those days doctors didn't know too much, so they said she should get some sea air. So we moved down to a seaside town called, it was sort of a little way up from Brighton. Most people know where Brighton is, but we lived in Hove. And my mother was there for a year and died of leukemia, what we now know to be leukemia. In those days they called it pernicious anemia, I think. Well, of course, my father wanted to go to services and have some sort of religious closure for his wife after his wife's funeral. So we went down to what was the only Reform temple that was in the area. Everything else was Orthodox. The Reform temple was very small. They didn't even have a building. They just met in someone's home. And at that time, they were looking for a rabbi because theirs had left. And they called Lady Lily Montague in London and asked her whether she knew of any young Reform rabbi who could come there and lead the congregation. And she said, yes, there's a young student who just arrived from America, and he's at Cambridge working on his PhD, and I'm sure that for the summer he would love to come down to a resort area and minister to the congregation and make a little money, because he's, like all students, I mean, he was broke. And he already had his rabbinical degree. He'd already graduated as a rabbi from the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. And what was interesting to me was that in order to get to England and get to Cambridge, he had to go by train from where he lived in Terre Haute, Indiana. And the train took him to, I think he went straight to, he had to make a change somewhere, either New York or Chicago, I don't know, but then he went on to Quebec, all by train. And when he got to Quebec, he took a boat. There were no planes. So he took a boat, commercial planes that is, a boat down to Portsmouth, and from there he took a train to Cambridge. And he was such a young man, it was quite a big step to do all this. And when he got to Cambridge, he lived in what they called digs. You rented rooms from people who had been approved by the college.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the gates of Cambridge and asked the gatekeeper, I'm here to see my tutor, Mr. Boyd Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And they said to him, oh, I'm very sorry, sir, but Mr. Boyd Smith isn't up yet.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, well, I'll come back later. So he went back an hour later and said, I'm sorry, sir, but he isn't up. So he said, well, all right, maybe the man, you know, has problems sleeping at night, mm-hmm. and sleeps during the day. But it wasn't until the second day that he found out that not being up meant he was not, if you were up, you were at Cambridge. If you mm-hmm. weren't at Cambridge, the higher seat of learning, any place else was down.
Mm-hmm.
Even Scotland, which was higher up than Cambridge, was mm-hmm. still down because this was the high seat of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a whole new language to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very happy to accept this post in Hove, and he came down. And he saw me sitting in the front row with my brothers and my father, and I was crying. And so after the service, he called me into the study and he said, what's the matter? And I told him that my mother was dying. And so he sort of took me under his wing right away, and he took long walks with me along the what we called the front, along mm-hmm. the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and would talk to me about life and death and what mm-hmm. God's meaning was. And he said years later, he said, I was so confident that I was telling you everything.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but now that I'm older and wiser, I'm not so sure that some of the answers I gave you were really the mm-hmm. answers, because he was new at it. Well, he consoled me and married me. That's mm-hmm. what happened. So when we came here to the United States, we had to come by boat. It was one of the last boats to sail out of England because mm-hmm. of the war. And strangely enough, the entire personnel on board, what do you call them on the ships?
Stewards? Crewmen?
Every crew member was a German. And it turned out that there were so many German spies in England while from 1933 on. They were working as au pair girls, they were working as nannies, they were working at anywhere they can infiltrate,
mm-hmm.
because they were... what was happening was a sort of a fifth column that mm-hmm. they were building up. And it was the same with the boat. Most of them were trying to get the crew members, I think, were mostly people trying to get away
mm-hmm.
for some reason or other, or maybe going to try and get into the States. But it was a very strange ship.
Mm-hmm.
It was very strange. Where do you want me to go from?
When did you arrive in the United States?
We arrived in New York,
uh-huh.
and the World's Fair was on. And my father and mother-in-law met us at the boat, and they said, we have tickets to go to the World's Fair. It was the 1939.
Uh-huh.
And the most significant thing at the World's Fair was that at the Russian Pavilion, when they pushed a button, and for the first time in the history of Russia, they had electricity all over Russia in 1939.
Wow.
And this was how backward they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, 10 years later, they were the most feared enemy that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder how a country that didn't have electricity until now, all over the country, that is,
mm-hmm.
in every home, how all this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we know now that a lot of it was window dressing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they became our most feared enemy.
Mm-hmm. How about your own? Dr. Berkowitz's dissertation. Do you remember what that was dealing with? Or?
Yes, it was a it was a critique of Kimchi on Amos
uh-huh.
From the Old Testament. And in order to do the research of the literature and the materials that he had to use, he had to learn Aramaic and Syriac,
mm-hmm.
which he did. I just gave away the Syriac dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to master these two dead languages before mm-hmm. he could decipher all of these, all this material. Now, his dissertation is at the Bodleian Library
mm-hmm.
in Cambridge.
Okay.
It's That's where, and another copy is at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, and I have the other one.
Where did you go after New York for the period?
We went to his parents' home in Terre Haute, Indiana, and because he had to look for a job. And what happened was he was promised a job at the Hebrew Union College to teach. He was going to teach homiletics. He was going to teach, I forget the subject, but whatever the subject was, he was definitely promised a post there. So we went to Cincinnati where he taught for a year. And after a year, the president of the Hebrew Union College, Dr. Morgenstern, called him in and said, I just want you to know that we have all these great scholars who are coming over as refugees from Germany, and they're all looking for asylum here because they've been persecuted by Hitler. And it's like a brain drain. They're all coming over here. And he said, we're supporting them, we're feeding them, we're housing them, so we feel that as long as we're doing that, we should give them jobs. And as soon as they can learn English, some of them did already speak English. So they said, whereas for someone like you, you're an American boy and you're young, and you won't have any trouble finding a pulpit anywhere, so you have to give up your job to a German refugee, which he did. So he was called to the a pulpit in Mobile, Alabama. And if you can imagine Mobile, Alabama, before the shipyards, before the war, before it was the most delightful. It was a sort of Tennessee William play type. And I found myself in this incredible atmosphere of azalea bushes and japonica bushes and camellias and gracious living and people with fans going back and forth over the dining room table, and of course. And people who still had chauffeurs and lived. And everyone said to me, how could you go to that decadent South? And I said, it was so much like England. I don't think I could have taken New York or Chicago. Go, go, go town. This was perfect for me. They stopped and they didn't have tea in the afternoon, but they lived very, very quietly, a very quiet pace, and I liked that. And the name of the temple was the Government Street Temple, and it was a magnificent building and quite old. And then, of course,
okay, Bonnie.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll talk to you later, Joe. Thank you.
Okay.
So it was my first experience of being a rabbi's wife, and I thought, goodness knows what they'd expect of me, but they didn't expect anything. They were just delighted to have a nice little English girl, which was a novelty in their lives. Just, they spoiled me tremendously. I mean, they couldn't have been, everyone was just wonderful to me. And they would invite us to their summer homes for the weekends and go fishing on their boats. And it was just a delightful life until, of course, suddenly it was cut short by the draft. And my husband was not, all ministers were exempt from the draft. And the only way they could go would be if they applied, if they presented themselves and said they would waive the the law. So Sidney went to the draft board and said that he wanted to be a part of the war effort, and they didn't have to pass any rigorous physicals like most people. I mean, it didn't matter if you had flat feet, because they figured you weren't going to be in actual combat, although some of them were. And from there, he was drafted, not drafted, but he was taken into the service as a lieutenant. And he was made a lieutenant and sent to Larry Field in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
So we had nothing to pack up. We didn't have anything in those days. So we just got in the car and just drove out to Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see America for the first time. I went through Kansas. You never saw a dog or a tree or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was just flat, and you never saw a soul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really a strange feeling for me. Because in England, if you go from here to there, everything's so close.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of driving through all those states and it was all empty.
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable. Occasionally you'd see a few cars. But we got to Larry Field, and he reported for duty. And he was in the 7th Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in Denver, where he did really, again, remarkable work. He shared a chapel with the chaplains of all denominations, and we all became very friendly. The whole group of us were friendly, and
mm-hmm.
to the point where they even came and visited us after the war, and we kept in touch.
Mm-hmm.
And they, for the most part, had never met a rabbi ever. And they were just so thrilled with it because they felt so liberal. You know? It was easy to like him, but it made them feel better
mm-hmm.
for knowing a rabbi, because normally most ministers are only busy with their own, just with their own congregation, and they're so very busy they don't have time for anybody else's
mm-hmm.
areas. So the fact that we used to all go to the officers' club together for dinner, and we'd take trips together, and we just, well, by trips that were very brief ones, because we were rationed on gasoline as
mm-hmm.
well. We couldn't go up to the mountains or go skiing or do anything like that, because that was all closed, and they'd taken over all the ski slopes, and they were training the ski troops.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, the prisoners of war were put up there in Colorado, up on the top of the mountains, and we visited them. My husband went up there because there were some Jewish boys who were guards.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we got there, and there were no restrictions. There wasn't even a gate, there wasn't even a wall around the place. And I
mm-hmm.
said, this is strange. I mean, can't they run away? And they said, where are they going to go? It's not like Europe, where you can get to the border in an hour.
Uh-huh.
He said they could walk forever, and they'd just be picked up, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's no place to go. And I said to this one Jewish boy, I said, doesn't it bother you to be guarding German prisoners? He says, well, they don't give me any trouble. He says, if they look at me wrong, he says, I just shove a bayonet and say, you know, it doesn't hurt them. He says, I just shove them the bayonet and tell them to get moving.
Mm-hmm.
So that part. And so he held a service up there. It was so isolated, it was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Up on this mountain, and you looked out, and there was just nothing but the other side of the
mm-hmm.
mountain. And you wonder how they got the supplies up there, how they managed. And of course, he went from one field to the other. There was several air bases, and he'd go around in Buckley Field, and I can't remember all of them, but they gave him special gasoline rations to go around and services
mm-hmm.
in all these various places. And I remember his remark. He said, when people tell me that all the Jews are smart, he said, I have proof positive that we have our share
mm-hmm.
of morons, stupid airheads. He said, I have young men from all over the country now
uh-huh.
that come to his chapel on Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the questions they ask him, and they're all so homesick, and they're, you know, and they're all so, and they're crying for their mothers. And
uh-huh.
he said, some of them, they're only good to push a broom.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, the army, if you're a lawyer, they'll make you drive a truck, and if you're a truck driver, they'll make you into a lawyer. This
mm-hmm.
is the way it was in the army. And he said, we have our share of every type in the world. He said, one boy who came to talked to him was a ballet dancer, another one, his father owned a delicatessen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just the most ordinary people. And there was one boy who said that he was a big shot in Hollywood. And so he says, oh, sure, everyone's a big shot when they're from out of town. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that even today you'll see his name on the screen of all the television screens, Hal Kaplan. He's a very famous mm-hmm. Hollywood writer. And he was at Larry Field, and we didn't realize how important he was until Cecil B. DeMille sent a special plane for him once to fly him back to Hollywood for some assignment.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
while he was a corporal in the army. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very interesting time. And our son, Roger, was born in Mercy Hospital while we were in Denver.
Uh-huh.
And right after Roger was born, he was sent overseas. And he went to Okinawa and Saipan.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty bad, I guess. It was very primitive and very rough.
Uh-huh. What rank did he attain?
He went overseas as a captain and he came back as a major.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So he ended up as a major.
After he was mustered out, when was that? Was that in 1945, 46?
Around that time. Yeah.
Was that when you arrived in Youngstown?
No, we went back to Mobile, and he said that after having been in Saipan and Okinawa and been in that terrible climate, he couldn't stand the southern climate anymore.
Uh-huh.
It just upset him too much. And I know he was offered a pulpit in New Orleans, and he didn't go for the same reason, because he didn't want to be in there. What he called jungle rot.
Uh-huh.
But of course we didn't know that air conditioning was going to happen. Had we known that there would be air conditioning, we never would have moved. We
mm-hmm.
would have stayed where we were. But he wanted to come north, and this was considered a very young congregation, a lot of young people, and
mm-hmm.
a very energetic congregation. He liked the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the idea of being in Ohio because I was closer to England. In those days, traveling was such an enormous thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would have taken me as long to go from Mobile to New York to get a boat or a plane
mm-hmm.
as it would to go across the Atlantic and get home. So I always felt that I wanted to be in Ohio and be closer to England that way. Because
mm-hmm.
my whole family was there, and I wanted, wanted to see them as often as I could.
Mm-hmm. How about a little bit about the procedure it took for, did he have to come for a series of interviews up in Youngstown, or was he referred here by the Hebrew?
What happened was the Hebrew Union College has a placement rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the one who's the placement rabbi right now is a Youngstown boy, Stanley Dreyfus,
mm-hmm.
and he's a rabbi also. And what happened was we were asked to come here. A series of rabbis came here. They would pay your expenses to come up, and then they'd pick you up at the Pick Ohio Hotel, and then you'd give a sample sermon.
Uh-huh.
And then after you left, they'd get together and decide which man they liked best and which one they wanted to hire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess my husband's credentials were sort of like a blockbuster compared with most.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them who had come had not served in the armed forces, and they took a dim view of that. And others didn't have their PhDs, and a lot of them weren't married, and they wanted a married man. And,
mm-hmm.
Or the wife was too domineering, or all these reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, whatever it was, they offered him this pulpit, and we came up on the train,
mm-hmm.
and we were met by Mr. Harold Clivens, who was president of the congregation at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we met him and met his wife, we knew we were going to like Youngstown, and it just
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm. What struck you about the city when you first arrived here?
I think I was still very, very homesick for England, and I didn't realize it, but after having lived in Mobile, Alabama, with all the beautiful flora and fauna,
uh-huh.
and gracious living, and then going, and then I was on an army base where there were a lot of young people, and mm-hmm. There was lots of activity, and my child was born there. I remember coming here and not quite relating to it all.
Uh-huh.
I had difficulty adjusting, and I didn't know why. I don't know if it was although this was a bustling steel town, and mm-hmm. a big social life, and as soon as we got here, we were invited to just about everything that went on in town, because mm-hmm. It was a new face, and they wanted to get to know us, so I think I was still a little lonesome for my family.
Mm-hmm.
But as a town, it was like nothing else I'd ever lived in.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like London, and it wasn't like Mobile, and it wasn't like Colorado, but of course I realized the immensity of this country and how there's a different personality to every area.
Mm-hmm.
And, I can't say that I had any really vivid recollections.
Mm-hmm.
It took me out to Mill Creek Park, and
mm-hmm.
I remember thinking, now, this is wonderful. And we had picnics out there, and I enjoyed taking Roger to the park, but I think Mill Creek Park was probably my best impression.
Mm-hmm.
Town itself.
How about the area where Rhoda Shalom is located now? What did it look like when you arrived? Was it a lot more residential?
Yes, yes, it was a nice quiet neighborhood, and very genteel people lived around
mm-hmm.
there. And although people were starting to move out more to the suburbs, the old houses were beautifully kept up.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an apartment building. Big apartment building right there on Wick Park,
mm-hmm.
and upper middle class people were living there,
mm-hmm.
and it was a very orderly sort of existence there.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to be afraid to go in any areas unless it was maybe even around the mills. The people who worked in the mills were hardworking,
mm-hmm.
decent people. They kept their houses up. They're very house proud. Those little wooden houses that they
mm-hmm.
had were just kept immaculately, and their gardens were kept so nicely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people were really had a different attitude, I guess, maybe now. Now everything's trashed.
Yeah.
And no one seems to understand why.
Mm-hmm. If you could, how about Elm Street, the area right around Rhoda Shalom? What was there? Was there other churches, businesses?
Well, Elm Street, of course, right up from Elm Street was Land School.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went up sort of half up to Bissell and Elm Street, there was all these hordes of children coming
mm-hmm.
out of school. And there was a corner drugstore, and they'd all go in there and have their ice cream and malteds and things after school. And in the 60s, I remember they had stores with water beds
mm-hmm.
that they were starting to sell. And there were stores where they were... they were making handmade jewelry,
mm-hmm.
and these were interesting, different sort of shops.
Mm-hmm.
And the penny pinchers who worked for Planned Parenthood, I guess they were, had their secondhand shop near the post office,
mm-hmm.
and people would take things in there so that they could sell them for charity.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a more affluent look, and the people who lived along Elm Street were people on fixed incomes who couldn't afford to live in a more affluent neighborhood, but lived very quietly and decently and nicely, and you had a sense of
mm-hmm.
order. There's an orderliness to it that mm-hmm. you don't see much of now. And now they say you can't even drive down Elm Street. It's a hot, you know, it's full of drugs. And where we lived on Madeira, at the end of the street, is a dead end, and the municipal swimming pool is there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been closed now, too. That used to be a wonderful pool. You could hear the kids yelling all over the neighborhood. It was a wonderful sound.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear the ice cream carts going by. It was just a sort of a lovely thing to have for the city. And then they started selling drugs, and the people who had the Dairy Queen were complaining about the pushes that they could see in plain daylight,
mm-hmm.
and what was happening to the kids, so they just closed the whole place down.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been open now for several years.
Mm-hmm. Was there also, along with Road of Shalom, there was also another Jewish congregation when you arrived?
Yes,
right next
Aunt Shemeth was,
uh-huh.
Was just about a block away,
mm-hmm.
and they were the conservative. It was the conservative congregation.
Mm-hmm. What was the religious climate like here?
Among the three Jewish factions?
Both the other religions and the three Jewish factions.
I would say by climate, I think there was a very nice understanding, and
mm-hmm.
and I know that whenever there was any kind of a function where you could involve the black ministers, the
mm-hmm.
Baptist ministers, the Catholic priests, anything where they could be involved, my husband always saw to it that
mm-hmm.
they were included. And I think everyone was familiar with that. Everyone, I don't think there was a denomination in town who had not visited our temple
mm-hmm.
and been welcomed and probably served a little refreshments and made
mm-hmm.
them feel completely at home. And all the symbols were explained to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to tie in the Old Testament with the New and
mm-hmm.
how it all evolved. And the it was just, everybody felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a feeling like here was the cathedral and,
mm-hmm.
and here was the Presbyterian church and then there was the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because in those days, I think years ago, it was a big social thing too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you belonged to a certain church, you were in. If you weren't, you were out, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all that was much diminished.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was much more of a democracy, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
among the churches.
Mm-hmm. How about when Dr. Berkowitz arrived here, when you both arrived here, was there a transition from, it was Rabbi Feinberg, or he already passed away than Feinberg,
yeah.
passed away, but
mm-hmm.
between him and Rabbi Philo, how did he become really involved within the temple? Was it just all a sudden, or?
Well, Dr. Philo was sort of an elitist,
uh-huh.
and the temple membership was very small, and he only wanted really pure reform
mm-hmm.
people who did not want any Hebrew, very little Hebrew, and of course certainly no dietary laws. And my husband made it possible for, I think what he did, I think he put the temple into the 20th century is what he did.
Mm-hmm.
People who would have loved to have been reformed, but they were too intimidated by the class of people
mm-hmm.
that was, they had at Road of Shalom. It would be like First Prayers, I guess, Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone who worked with his hands for a living would be a little intimidated by
mm-hmm.
joining the city fathers. But he made it possible for anybody who had reform leanings, who wanted that type of service and religion, to just join, and he invited them to join.
Mm-hmm.
And when the word got around that they were all welcome,
mm-hmm.
as long as they just went along with the rules and regulations that were made clear to them,
mm-hmm.
It was like the gold rush. There was a tremendous upsurge in membership.
Mm-hmm.
I think it went from a handful of maybe 100 people went to, well, I think the peak was 700 families.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who no longer had any use for religion came back because they said, this is the kind we can accept.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the Jewish people had, really had were in conflict over their religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to reconcile what happened to the Jewish people in Germany and being able to go to temple and,
mm-hmm.
and ask God why he allowed it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were in conflict, terrible conflict after that.
Mm-hmm.
And by just going to an Orthodox temple and repeating the same familiar prayers in Hebrew wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to go to a temple where the rabbi was truly enlightened, that if something came up in the headlines of the newspaper that alarmed them,
mm-hmm.
or made them uneasy, that they could go to temple and he would talk to them and they'd all feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And this he did all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If there was some crisis, say, between Russia and the United States, and it looked as if we were coming off poorly, he would always say, well, this is the way it looks now, but a little way up the road, it's going to be the Russians are going to be in trouble because...
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, hey, you know,
mm-hmm.
maybe it isn't so bad. And no matter how bad it was, he could always make you feel as if there were two sides to it, and other people had their problems too,
mm-hmm.
and that just to have faith in the United States, and we know that everything's going to be
mm-hmm.
going to be okay. I was so sorry that he wasn't around when he saw the dissolution of the USSR.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave the type of sermons that were always timely.
Mm-hmm.
If something had happened now, to most ministers, they have these set speeches and set
mm-hmm.
talks. So if something, like if the president were assassinated that same day, they'd have a tough time talking about it
mm-hmm.
because they'd had their sermon all prepared. But he was always prepared at the last minute to speak
mm-hmm.
on anything that had happened that were upsetting people.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the day that Kennedy was shot, people didn't know what to do, and they just all ran down to the temple
mm-hmm.
and had my husband talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in shock himself, but he was able to calm everybody down and tell them it wasn't the end of the world, and they'd sleep safely in their houses. I mean, people were absolutely petrified when things like that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. He always helped them through such difficult times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know by now that his work was not just limited to his own congregation.
Mm-hmm.
But people came, if they were unemployed, they came to see him, see if he could call this one or call that one. If they had a falling out with their own minister and couldn't talk to him, they'd come to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember to the extent that two girls came to see him and they wanted to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, how long have the two of you been going together? And they said, oh, 7 years. And he said, well, why do you want to get married now? And they said, because we want to adopt a child. So he asked them their denomination, and they told him. And he said, well, what did your priest say? Well, the priest just threw us out. He wouldn't even talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, what happened with yours? He said, well, mine said he was going to call our parents. And so they said, you're the only one who's listened to us.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, according to law, he said, I can't marry you
mm-hmm.
in this state. But I advise you to go to California, where you'll find someone who will marry you. And you will also be treated much more kindly by the community.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a much better chance of adopting a child. He said, in Ohio, it'll never fly.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't get over that he just discussed it like any other problem.
Mm-hmm. If you could, speaking of much things I have now to ask, but I want to get these two that are a little bit shorter questions. Could you just describe what Road of Shalom looks for me, or how it looks physically, the physical appearance of both the sanctuary and the building itself?
Well, the building itself was built the way St. Peter's was built, really. The purpose of St. Peter's, with the blue dome, of course, was to have heaven and earth meet.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it had the arms by Bernini, the columns of Christianity embracing the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, we couldn't quite do anything that impressive, But I think they wanted to give a feeling of a solid feeling about it. We're here, and we're staying here, and we're for the ages.
Mm-hmm.
And they could only do that by putting up heavy brick and concrete,
mm-hmm.
and by making it large enough and impressive enough so that it would be a landmark, so that it would be known to people, and so that it would give a feeling of permanence, I think is what they wanted mostly. It wasn't to impress anybody so much as to have permanence, give it a permanent feeling. I mean, it's not the same as meeting in a church basement like some of the synagogues do in California.
Mm-hmm.
They rent the basement, you know, they rent the church basement for the day, and this is how they meet. They can't afford a temple. They wanted to show that the people here were solid businessmen. They were serious people, and they wanted something of beauty, because that's everybody has their own idea as to what architectural beauty is. But I think mostly people like the dome. They're impressed by the dome, and which is sort of a Byzantine look, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably fashionable then to do it that way.
How about the pulpit? What would your husband wear to a service Friday night?
Well, he wore his clerical robe.
Uh-huh.
He wore a silk one in the summertime that was very, very lightweight, and a heavier gown in the winter.
Uh-huh.
It was almost a taffeta feel to it. And he had the PhD stripes, the PhD velvet stripes on the robe, and he had his Cambridge stole.
Uh-huh.
And he also had a stole that he wore when he was a chaplain, and it had the Ten Commandments on it for his services. But he didn't wear those at the temple. He just wore the robe.
Okay.
And of course, he did not wear a hat of any kind, a head covering of any kind. Okay.
The tape broke. If you're watching. Move along. Could you physically describe your husband for me?
He was short and dark and dynamic. And you could not be as close to him, say, as we are sitting here without feeling this enormous energy.
Uh-huh.
He had an energy that just sort of just was like it was like a ray of light, really.
Uh-huh.
This enormous energy is the first impression you have on him.
Uh-huh.
He had dark brown eyes and very soft eyes, and he was an extremely compassionate man, and when you were talking to him, you'd see his eyes changing expression as he immediately grasped what you were telling him.
Mm-hmm.
He never looked at you with the vacant looks of, say, well, now run that past me again, or what did you say? I mean, he was with it all the time and on top of everything. Okay.
All the community activities he got involved with within the Youngstown area, was this a gradual assumption of duties, or rephrase it, he didn't immediately delve into everything when he arrived into Youngstown. It was just once he became involved, he stayed involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to understand, he had this incredible energy.
Uh-huh.
And when he would be asked to be on a board, he was so valuable to them, because I know on several occasions when his term of office was finished, they wouldn't let him go, and they'd give him an honorary position just to keep him on that board, because apparently he was able to solve problems so easily, and he was able to go right to the point so easily, and he could see things so clearly, and he had such a lucid mind that they just didn't want him to leave. And I think what happened was if there was a group of people around a table and they heard him speak or make a decision or help solve a problem, they'd say, hey, he's the kind of man I want on my board.
Uh-huh.
And so he was just invited to to join all these various mm-hmm. organizations to the point where there wasn't anything that he wasn't involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his highest honor was probably when he was on the National Board of the Red Cross.
Uh-huh.
Because you had, even though, I mean, there were people like Roland Harriman and the one time I went to Washington with him for this meeting of the National Board of the Red Cross, and we went into the F Club. The F Club is a very modest looking building,
mm-hmm.
and you've got some very modest steps, and when you walk in you sink in up to your knees in the carpeting,
mm-hmm.
and there are men servants walking around with platters of hors d'oeuvres, and it was the most incredible experience.
Uh-huh.
And Avril Harriman was there with his wife Pamela Churchill.
Uh-huh.
And I cannot remember the names of various people, but they were all I would say the upper 5%
mm-hmm.
of America, not maybe even less than that. They were all CEOs and they owned America, the people that I met that night at this dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And because I remember one man said that his son was on a hiking tour around Europe and he was laughing. He said, any time he runs out of money, he'll call me. He says, no, I'll just call a bank and they'll give him a job.
Mm-hmm.
Just wherever he is, mm-hmm. they'll just give him a job in the bank. And these are people that had homes everywhere but were giving their time to the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And being on this board was a very useful thing too for my husband, because I know that there were families who were trying to get their boys back from, their bodies back from Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
who'd been killed. And no one could get them back.
Mm-hmm.
And these families were in a state of suspension. They wanted to have a service, they wanted to, they wanted some sort of closure with this grief, this horrible grief that they had. So they called Dr. Berkowitz, and he made a call to the International Red Cross, and those bodies were back in 48 hours
mm-hmm.
from Vietnam. So, I mean, he was able, he never used his clout for himself.
Mm-hmm.
He only used it always for other people.
Mm-hmm.
He was always raising money, but it was never for him.
Mm-hmm.
It was always for causes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing what this energetic person could accomplish in mm-hmm. a day.
Okay. Let's talk about, what would you do in a day? Do you have some schedules here, I see. Could you describe what a day would be like, what time you'd get up?
Well, he was usually up between 5 and 6 o'clock. And he was at the office between 7:30 and 8,
mm-hmm.
depending on the schedule. And I think his secretaries could probably tell you
mm-hmm.
more about it, because I never followed him around for
mm-hmm.
a day. But I know that when I wanted to see him about something really important, I had to make an appointment,
mm-hmm.
because his day was just jammed.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come to see him during the morning. He had sermons to write, he had speeches to write,
mm-hmm.
prepare anyway, he didn't write them out, but he had to prepare speeches.
Mm-hmm.
He had an enormous correspondence,
mm-hmm.
huge, and he was dictating to the secretary, or two secretaries. And the lunch would always be a business lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It would always be either the Easter Seal or the Planned Parenthood,
mm-hmm.
or the Red Cross. It would always be that kind of a meeting
mm-hmm.
lunch. By business, I mean a meeting lunch. And he had all of the phone calls that were just, phone calls that came in were just crushing, really,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of them, so the secretaries had to screen them.
Mm-hmm.
They'd give him the list and then he'd tell them which ones were emergencies and he'd talk to you right away.
Mm-hmm.
And he usually came home around 5 o'clock or 5:30 because
mm-hmm.
he wanted to have his dinner and then he had to leave immediately for a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to arrange my schedule so that I could be home at that time so that I can have his dinner ready.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would, I'd say about four evenings a week he would have meetings to go to after
mm-hmm.
dinner, or condolence calls to make, or call on people in their homes for various mm-hmm. reasons, pastoral calls. He would devote one afternoon a week to the hospital visitation,
mm-hmm.
maybe sometimes two depending on the number of patients in the hospital. And he had an arrangement for the hospital that when he would walk in, they would hand him the list
mm-hmm.
of people to see. Knew him. If you go to a parking lot, they'd say, got your space right here. You know, everyone would cooperate with
uh-huh.
him because they knew how busy he was. They knew what the good he was doing for everybody.
Uh-huh.
And so they sort of paved the way for him wherever he went.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest of the evenings, that when he wasn't going to a meeting, we usually had to go to a wedding or a banquet.
Mm-hmm.
I would say four nights a week we'd go to meetings and three nights a week we'd go to dinners
mm-hmm.
of some kind. And occasionally we'd go out for social reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not, he just worked all the time.
Mm-hmm. Even prior to starting this project, I had done some research and his name came up with a couple things with the civil rights movement. I was doing some research in there. Was he very involved within the local community or nationally with the civil rights movement?
That time, for some reason, a little bit vague in my mind.
Uh-huh.
I know having lived in Mobile, Alabama, he had tremendous sympathy
uh-huh.
for the plight of the good black people
uh-huh.
down there. And I don't recall any one thing that he said to me about it. I think it was just a sort of a tacit sympathy
mm-hmm.
agreement that he had that he would help them mm-hmm. as much as he could.
How about I did some work with the Vietnam War era. Him and Bishop Malone and Reverend Spiker all attended a anti-war rally. Was he in any way involved with that movement?
Well, I don't think people really understood that war and what it was
right.
all about. And I know the Vietnam veterans must feel who fought and went through such terrible things must feel very upset about that. But I think at the time, it was like, it was the Catholics against the Communists
mm-hmm.
is what that war was all about, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The Catholic South against the Communist North.
Right.
And it was a religious war.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think any of us quite understood why we were throwing so much money and so much
uh-huh.
Manpower and making go through these horrors in a jungle. You know, these young boys. And I remember LBJ making a statement, well, there are less fellows killed over there than in automobile accidents on our roads.
Uh-huh.
And how horrified we are when we heard that. We said, but they shouldn't be killed on the roads and they shouldn't be being killed out there
yeah.
either. And I think it was just his general antipathy towards wars
mm-hmm.
and sending innocent boys out to causes that they don't even know why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that World War II was more justified in view of the fact that we would have had a maniac taking over all of Europe,
mm-hmm.
which then of course would have upset the whole balance of power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think too many people understood what Vietnam was all about.
Mm-hmm. How about his relationship with Bishop Malone and Reverend Spiker? Well, the ecumenical development within the community.
I think he respected Reverend Spiker very much, but I think he really loved James Malone.
Uh-huh.
And he said he has such a fine mind, wonderful mind.
Uh-huh.
Such a gentle person. And I remember Bishop Malone saying, when I was a priest, I was not interested in the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I had enough with my own parish. And they were just a group over there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, then he said, I met Sidney Berkowitz. And after I talked to him, he said, these people are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I was never with them that I didn't learn something
mm-hmm.
about my own religion and his.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was able to see his own religion from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that Sidney was so honest in his responses about everything,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he would never say, mine's the right way, or, I mean, he would never,
mm-hmm.
he respected Bishop's position and what his work was here in the community, and I think, and because Bishop Garth was here, wasn't it? Not Garth, Bishop
Walt.
Bishop Burt
okay.
from the Protestants.
Burt Cantrell?
John Burt from
St. John's.
From St. John's. Okay. And they used to call them the Big Three.
Uh-huh.
There was Berkowitz, there was Malone, and there was Burt,
mm-hmm.
who were our team. His wife, Martha. Right, we knew Martha very well, too. And it was that wonderful feeling that everything, if the three of them worked together, they could solve anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I think they had a wonderful effect on the community because they only worked for the good
mm-hmm.
of the people. And I think they broke down a lot of old taboos, and I think they just sort of led the way for a lot of people
mm-hmm.
and told them how they should think about others and how they should act.
Mm-hmm.
towards others, because they weren't going to learn it in their own homes.
Mm-hmm.
They'd follow the same old prejudice and same old patterns. And I think when they saw these three ministers working together, I think
mm-hmm.
it had a profound impact on people. I remember one day, it was after a Saturday service, and my husband said, I want to go to a place in Lowerville. I said, Lowerville? He said, yes, there's a place there that has some good spaghetti. I was told about it, and I want to find it. So we get in the car, and we drive in a pouring rain and mud, and we finally get to this place. He said, I just have a feeling, it just felt like getting out of town. I want to go somewhere where no one will know me,
mm-hmm.
and the phone won't ring, and I just want a little bit of peace and quiet. He was in that kind of a mood.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk in, there's a whole bunch of fellas sitting at a bar, and one man turns around, stares at him, and after a while he looks at Sidney, and he says, hey, he says, haven't I seen you on television with my bishop?
Mm-hmm.
So he says, even here, I couldn't get away from it. It's really funny.
Okay, there's a couple other things that I have to get going here. How about with the labor movement in Youngstown, the steel? I know he's very instrumental in trying to keep the steel mills open
after the
announcement.
Yes, they formed a, it's called Save the Valley.
Uh-huh.
And maybe somewhere I still have some of the armbands and things and things, bumper stickers that people
uh-huh.
had. But of course it was impossible. Once those steel mills were, they were obsolete. They hadn't replaced any
right.
machinery. And once the union guys packed their bags and left town, there was nothing they could do.
Mm-hmm.
They were powerless really, but they did try. They felt that the union men should have stayed here and retrained the steel workers to do something else so that they could find jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But that was never done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well,
we could finish up. How about, you were talking before we started the tape about his sense of humor. Could you reiterate some of those points? What was it like? Any specific occasions, things that really made you laugh, anything you did or said?
Well, it's hard to explain, but it was like he was that way all the time.
Mm-hmm.
From the time he woke up until he went to bed at night, he had this constant. And he would say something funny, then I would say something funny back, and then
mm-hmm.
he'd say something funny. It was like a tennis match going,
mm-hmm.
and we'd be laughing constantly about everything that was
mm-hmm.
happening and going on. And there was never anything happened that was bad that got you down or made you depressed, that we couldn't find some humorous side to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his humor was a very healing thing for a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
too, because they looked at it from they looked at the problem from a different angle completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had the same quality as Johnny Carson in
mm-hmm.
that respect. You'd hear all these terrible things happening at the White House or in Washington, and he'd get on and he'd say a few words and everyone would start laughing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't quite so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sidney had the same quality, except Johnny Carson had $10,000 gag writers writing to him. Every word he said was $10,000
mm-hmm.
worth of gag writing, whereas Sidney had his own, I mean, he manufactured his own humor
uh-huh.
and his own intelligence that made him see everything from a different point of view.
Okay. I'll let you go here. I see that
yeah.
getting close
yeah.
here. But